Today's plenary is going to build on the opening session of last night. You were told at that time about the Wingspread 2007 conference, and I identify it by year because actually it was the third Wingspread conference that AFCC developed, or in this last case, co-developed. And last night you also heard about the two organizations, AFCC and National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges. Peter Salem was here, who is the executive director of AFCC. And I want to introduce to you, at least by having her stand up, just to show who she is, take this opportunity to introduce Billy Lee Dumford Jackson, who just retired as the co-director of the Family Violence Department of NCJ-FCJ. And Billy Lee was the co-conspirator with Peter Salem of developing this conference. So what we're going to do today is we're going to continue with and expand upon the thinking from that conference. And to moderate this distinguished and global panel, I have the great pleasure to introduce to you Nicholas Bala. He has been a professor at the Faculty of Law at Queen's University since 1980, and has been a visiting professor at Osgoode Hall Law School, McGill, Duke, and the University of Calgary. Professor Bala's primary area of teaching and research interest is family and children's law, focusing on such issues as child abuse, child witnesses, domestic violence, juvenile justice, parental rights and responsibilities after divorce, spousal support obligations, and the legal definition of the family. Please welcome Professor Nicholas Bala.
Thank you very much. This is an interdisciplinary panel. I'm a law professor, and there are three mental health professionals who will be presenting with me. On my left is Jen McIntosh. Jen is a clinical child psychologist and researcher from Australia. She is an associate professor at the University of La Trobe in Melbourne, and she is the director of a clinic that works with children who've been traumatized by divorce and also dealing with attachment issues. This, as I said, it's an interdisciplinary panel, and some of my co-presenters are suffering from a little bit of anxiety because we are presenting without PowerPoint, which is, of course, the way that lawyers do. However, in your materials, there is a set of PowerPoints and notes and a bibliography that go with this presentation. So if you're going along saying, where are the PowerPoints, they're in your notes. And also, because some of my fellow presenters are a little bit anxious, I have a little worry ball for when they come up here. The other two panel members are going to come up in a moment, but I just want to introduce the topic that we're focusing on, issues of domestic violence. And, of course, these are very difficult cases. As we heard last night, in many cases the violence is less. There's less risk and danger after separation, particularly the fact that there may have been violence during the relationship. Separation is a positive indication that the level of violence and perhaps even over time the level of conflict will reduce. On the other hand, there is another smaller but very dangerous set of cases in which separation may be increasing the risk of lethality. And unfortunately and tragically here in Canada, as elsewhere in the world, we've had a number of cases, and most recently in Calgary, as reported in the media, there was five members of one family were killed in a domestic murder-homicide. There have been other cases here in British Columbia, so that reminds us of the tremendous risk and danger in these cases, the potential for it, and on the other hand, the fact that there are other cases which are clearly less dangerous and may be resolved in a way that meets the interests of children with a continuing involvement of both parents. And so the question is how to distinguish those and how to differentiate. That's one of the themes of the session. This is an area where there's also been a lot of professional disagreement, and I think we've been hearing about that, about the Wingspread process, and we're very fortunate to have two of the leading representatives of different perspectives here are going to come up and now present, and I'll introduce them and then they'll come up. We're going to have over here on your left, Janet Johnson. Janet Johnson is a clinical researcher from the University of San Jose State, where she works in the Department of Justice Studies. She's someone who has done a tremendous amount of research and clinical work with high-conflict families. And she is someone who has been known as a representative, if you want, of the family conflict or the family court process, and she's going to be coming up here. I'll also introduce Peter Jaffe, who's going to come up at this time as well. Dr. Peter Jaffe is a professor, a clinician, and researcher at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario. He is certainly well known as someone who's been an advocate for and worked with victims of domestic violence, particularly women and their children. We're first going to hear from Peter, who's going to tell us about some of the ideas that advocates have been putting forward, some of the concerns they have.
Jan, I think that applause was for you. I want to say that I'm very honored to be here and very honored to be part of this conference. And I also want to add my support to the hard work that Peter Salem and Billy Lee Dunford Jackson have done through Winspread and the follow-up. I want to start by saying that although I'm encouraged by the work, I think we have a long way to go. If one were to conclude from the session last night, what the research says, that we'd all be directed to thinking about violence as something that's gender symmetrical, and one of the major findings we now have is that women are just as violent as men. As a matter of fact, our national newspaper, one of them a while ago, had a headline story after a national survey. Headline story was, women are just as violent as men, based on a national survey. What they didn't include in the story was the fact that women are more likely to be killed, injured, live in fear with their partner. So there's some significant gender differences, which I think I'm worried that our research and clinical practice is going to minimize. You know, if we were here 100 years ago talking about whether or not women should have a vote, you recall that women didn't always have a vote. Not all of you were alive at the time. but if we were to engage a bunch of researchers and we had a mini wink spread dealing with whether women should vote, we'd all end up doing research about the fact that some men who do have the vote don't actually vote and don't enjoy voting, and that would become the dialogue. And I want you to think about the fact that there is a historical inequality. And the work we do, both with individuals and families, has an important context. My concern is that what we euphemistically often call conflict, in fact, quite often, is violence against women and children. Now, I want to be very clear. Nobody who's works in shelters, nobody who works as advocates for abuse victims doesn't recognize that there are women who are violent too. There are men who are abused. That's clearly understood. But there is a significant difference when you start to look at the reality of the assaults that take place. Anybody guess what percentage of sexual assault is committed by men? If your guess was 95%, you'd be right. Do we call assault and rape of women a women's issue? Or do we call it a men's issue? Why isn't rape and sexual assault a men's issue for all men to think about? If you say 95% of rapes and sexual assault are committed by men, it doesn't mean that all men are sexually assaulting women, but it means that all men have an individual and collective responsibility to speak out on issues of sexism in the same way they do on issues related to racism or homophobia. We have to find ways to engage men in this discussion rather than turning the debate into women are just as violent as men. And I say that with somebody who loves men. I love my father. I have four boys. I have great confidence in what men can contribute to the movement and the understanding. But we have to be able to name the issue loud and clear. And my worry is we fail to do that. All of us live in very underfunded systems, and those systems are often judged by how we deal with the most vulnerable individuals that appear before them. My concern is that quite often we ask judges and custody evaluators and mediators to be like brain surgeons, and all we give them is a hammer and a chisel. And I recognize we have systems that are really totally underfunded to do the complex jobs, but I think it's important we focus on those who are most vulnerable and most in risk of death and serious injury. I think our training as mental health professionals and judges is to be neutral. We want to be everybody's friend. We all love mothers and fathers equally. How many love mothers and fathers equally? We all love mothers. We have trouble. We have trouble actually naming the issue. We want to be everybody's friend. And the problem is, when you're everybody's friend, you're nobody's friend, because you're not holding people accountable for the reality of the violence that actually happens. In Ontario, I sit on a domestic violence death review committee, and clearly I work with a biased sample. I'm looking at tragedies. Well, in the last 5 years, 94% of all homicides are committed by men against female partners, often those who've left relationships. If you look at who stalks, who harasses, who tracks down, clearly there's a significant gender difference. This is not a gender-neutral issue, no matter how much we want to try to have the research say that. We all feel better when we can say this is family violence or this is domestic violence. It's a lot harder when you start to speak loud and clear about the fact that this is very much about violence against women and children. Women in our society are most in danger from men who they love or loved. Men are most in danger from other men. And dealing with this issue in an open way, talking about the way we socialize boys and men, is going to do more to protect all women and all men much more than trying to turn this into a gender-neutral issue. And I'm very concerned about this. The leading part of the media industry now is focused on pornography, violent pornography. If we look at what men are exposed to, who consumes violent pornography? Who coerces partners being involved in that? Do we consider that as part of our custody evaluations that we ask people about use of violent pornography? I'm not talking about things that may be erotic. I'm talking about violent pornography involving women and violent degrading acts. Do we ask those questions? And do we then make judgments about someone's ability to parent? Again, these are important questions that we really haven't discussed until recently. So as long as we're gender neutral, we're going to minimize the level of violence and not offer the safety and support that's required. And we don't do enough risk assessment. I'm not sure how many custody evaluators or judges have a handy risk assessment tool, but clearly some of the things we heard from Joan Kelly last night about lethality, we need to have risk assessment tools. They need to be utilized in a much more active way. We also need to look at much more accountability for abusers. I mean, do we hold people who are abusive to some standard? I mean, again, I don't want to use the worst example to characterize the field, if you look at, look in California, I mean, O.J. Simpson, who was found, guilty in a civil court of killing his ex-partner, was still seen as fit for custody. So as long as we give a message that you can kill the children's mother and still have custody of the children, I think we have a long way to go in terms of really recognizing this issue and talking about it rather than simply talking about issues around in closing, I guess I want to say that quite often I feel that victims of violence get re-victimized by the system. And my experience, and again, clearly, listening to Joan Kelly last night, clearly we all are working with very biased populations. Potentially, what I see are cases of high risk, and clearly I might be dealing with a very biased sample, but the abuse victims that I talk to, 90-95% of whom are women, talk about the fact that first they get told the violence didn't happen, then they get told it did happen but it wasn't really that bad, or they get told it was bad but it's not really relevant for terming child custody because the dad never laid a hand on the kids. Or they get told, it was really bad, maybe it's relevant, but get on with your life. Because the system is all focused. The system all looks for the same quick fix. We all want everybody to resolve their conflicts as quickly as possible, put the past behind them. We keep telling people, this is the first day of the rest of your life, as parents. Put the past behind you. Well, you can't put the past behind you when it informs your safety planning and your strategies for risk reduction. I think we often overlook that. So I'm really concerned that even talking about this issue, every time I'm trotted out and to any stage, I'm seen as somebody who hates men. And I want to be very clear that I love men. I want men to be actively engaged. I want men to talk openly. I'm concerned about the future for my sons. I'm concerned that we live in a society where Grand Theft Auto 4, a video game, and 94% of video games involve themes of violence, sells $500 million worth in 1 week. And it's a game where you're involved killing police officers. It's a game where you're also involved killing prostitutes. You have sex with them, you release them from the car, and then you kill them and get the money back. This is mainstream society. These are the games that we consider acceptable. You're not playing them, but your sons are playing them, and we have to think about the kind of society that we're creating. And if we don't name issues around male socialization and what the real issues around violence, we're doing everyone a major injustice. Thank you.
asked to talk about the complaints that I hear from about advocates. And I think they derive from two sources. First, advocates by definition have access to only one party of the custody dispute, most often the woman. Anyone who has worked in family court services and in courts know that one can never understand the whole picture from the vantage point of only one parent. At times we wonder if we're even talking about the same family when parents are interviewed separately, alone. The information gleaned from one parent is invariably incomplete, and it may be unreliable, it may be invalid. Second, the sole dominating discourse about domestic violence by advocates has been in terms of power and control, as if no other dynamic were relevant. The spectre of the male batterer and the battered women have emerged as sort of archetypes. Ask around, ask professionals, ask people on the street, how would you describe a typical DV situation? And I will wager that most will describe the scenario of a male exerting abusive power and control over a battered woman by beating up on her emotionally, physically, and in every other way possible. Why this unidimensional view of DV? This picture derives from the successful activism of victims' advocates who have called attention to a subgroup of women who are terribly victimized. In order to advance the political agenda, advocates have cited research selectively, from shelter samples, from crime reports, from death reviews, about this one type of violence with which they are most familiar and tend to ignore, misinterpret, or even trash other data that might dilute or weaken their clarion call for action on behalf of this subgroup of truly victimized people. But this is a simplistic and unrealistic response to the complexity and enormous variation of what is seen in family courts. The rhetoric of the power and control wheel is repeated ad nauseam, such that many family court professionals in the field for some time feel irritated and patronized by the refrain. At this point, I could rest my case, but let me list some of the gripes that flow from this one-sided emphasis and the simplistic view of DV. Now, what I'm going to say by no means claims to represent the views of family court professionals in general, and certainly not that of AFCC. First, advocates are perceived to focus almost exclusively on the father's violence and abuse and have ignored the mother's violence. Listen to the language that they use. Complaints by women are called disclosures, and men who refute them are assumed to be denying and minimizing. Complaints by men about a partner's violence are called allegations, and their veracity questioned. Women's violence is excused as reactive, as a response to having been abused by a partner, or it is justified as an attempt to protect themselves or their children. Men's violence is seen as a willful and inexcusable act. Second, whereas a violent father's parenting is supposed to be critically examined, and rightfully so, any problem with the victim mother's parenting are not supposed to be talked about, or the problems are seen solely as the consequence of her victimization. Thirdly, moreover, the child's needs are assumed to be equivalent to the mother's needs or the victim mother's needs and interests. It seems as if advocates appear to believe that if mother is okay, the kids will be okay. If she is getting what she wants and does what she needs to do, she will take good care of what the kids need. Fourth, advocates are perceived to dismiss the importance of father-child relationships. The fact is, most children, even those whose fathers have been abusive, do love and they want to see their father, and these men, although flawed, usually have something of value to offer their kids. The indiscriminate labeling of all fathers who have been violent as batterers, it's an ugly word, it dehumanizes and vilifies them as monsters. It follows that the subhuman species are irredeemable. They need to be punished, excluded, and controlled. At the same time, the nonviolent parent, usually the mother, is sanctified as an entirely innocent victim who has earned a free pass. That is, no demands are supposed to be made for her accountability. It's a medieval moralistic view of good of evil versus good. It's a perpetrator-victim dichotomy, and it produces a whole set of problems. Firstly, calls for the separation of the parties, the exclusion of a parent who has been violent entirely from the family, and this does break up families, sometimes unnecessarily and against the wishes of both parents. It sometimes negates the personal, the religious, and the cultural values of some of these families. Second, it prevents or throws up institutional barriers to mediation and family counseling services being offered, being provided, even when both parents want them and could benefit from them, and the victims are not required to get the counseling or help they need. For example, laws are passed preventing family counseling. Laws are passed forbidding mutual restraining orders from being given. And the issue of victim-offender mediation and therapeutic jurisprudence is considered something of a no-no. Finally, it often calls for, it encourages instead traditional adversarial litigation that will put stress on all family members and escalate the polarization and conflict. Family court professionals who are confronted with a wide array of family and parental dysfunction in highly conflicted and violent custody disputing families find these kind of beliefs and assumptions problematic, if not mystifying. These are systematically biased views. The family court is required to administer gender-neutral statutes, so of course compelling evidence is needed to support allegations if parents' basic civil rights are at stake. Thank you.
Nick, you gave her more time. Do I get...
You both took longer than you were offered, but have a seat here. Before we hear a little more from you, I think I want to bring back Jen into the conversation. And Jen, of course, just works directly with children, and will talk to us a bit about the child's perspective.
Gladly. You know, I have a number of things to say from the developmental point of view, but frankly, I've been sitting here, and I've been trying to imagine what would the kids in my clinic want to say to these two. And I think it would look a little bit like this. Could you please tell Jan and Peter that this is a bit scary? Because they sound a little bit like my mum and dad.
She started.
I'm not finished with you yet, Dad.
Peter has a failing memory. If I recall, he started.
Now, if my mum and dad, if Janet and Peter go on like this for another decade about father's rights and about mother's rights, we're not going to get very far at all with kids' rights. That is, you know, our rights to be living our lives without our parents' violence getting stuck inside us. This is my concern, and I have a couple of kids here who say this a little bit better than I do. These are two children who were involved in the recent Australian parliamentary inquiry into shared parenting. And this is just a small snippet. This is Rachel is 9 and Jessie is 11. They'll speak for themselves.
I'll remember the good times, but I think I'll probably remember all the fighting as well, because I don't think that I could actually get that out of my mind, or I won't be, like, that sad about it, but I will still remember that all my life, how my parents, like, fired it.
Yeah, you get that hypnotizing thing. I mean, hypnotize the out of your brain. That'd be cool.
You'd want to hypnotize the pain away so you didn't have to remember it and you didn't have to feel it, huh?
Yeah. I think I would pay a lot of money to get it out of my mind. Because it's just constantly running through my mind. And it could, and it disturbs me with my schoolwork. And it actually, sometimes it actually puts a bit of violence into me. So.
In what way?
Like if when I'm older, when, if I have my kids, I could be violent to them like I was violent to, like, our parents, like, sometimes when our parents were that violent to us. And I could scream at them or something. But they did, like, such a little thing. Yeah, like, make the same mistakes that they made. I think
children's efforts to adapt to violence and to carry unresolved histories of family trauma are really costly at the individual level and also at the level of public health. And my concern about this debate that we've just heard, aside from my fatigue and my frustration with it, is that these polarised takes on domestic violence actually get us not very far at all in thinking about how children recover from it. So, and these debates, you know, they mimic adversarial process, and I'm sitting here and thinking we've got all the elements. We've got mother versus father, we've got claim, we've got counterclaim, we've got blame, we've got which parent's rights are righter. And because we're talking about parents, there's an implication that children are in there somewhere. I really want to challenge this sort of debate. I want to challenge, while I'm at it, typologies and screening tools, including the triple P, which we'll hear a little bit about, that continue to deal with domestic violence between parents as if it were a gendered dyadic concern, and where children remain an implication, a footnote in the conversation. The kind of debate that I'm interested in having is this one. What if we could realign our thinking around a different set of questions, around a developmental set of questions? Might that not lead us to a more integrated view? What about these questions? What do integrated outcomes look like for children in domestic violence? What is the capacity of each parent to contribute to those outcomes? What legal processes and what nature of parenting plan would promote the developmental recovery of the child? This is the kind of debate that I'm interested in having. What do you think?
Now, we've been going through a process here, and to some extent we've set Peter and Jan up at opposite ends of the stage to symbolize the fact there has been disagreement and differences of view, profound differences between those who have been advocates for women and those who've been working the family court movement. In fact, and I should say, if you have a cell phone, please turn on to vibrate when someone's just going, we've had advocates on one side and family court professionals on the other, and often not speaking to each other or speaking from opposite ends of a podium. And I certainly feel very privileged to have been involved in the Wingspread process that has, in fact, resulted in an effort to try to collaborate. And some of you may be aware that the next issue of the Family Court Review, which is online and here, has an article that was co-authored by Peter, was the lead author, Jan was the second author, I was the fourth author, and it brings together a number of perspectives and develops these what we're referring to as the PPP screening, and we're going to talk about that a little bit, and there will be a number of sessions that develop it in greater depth. But before talking about PPP, and we're going to talk about that, I want to come back to the issues of topologies. We heard about them yesterday. Talk a little bit about the strengths and risks of using topologies, what your views of the panelists here are about the topologies we heard yesterday. Maybe we'll start with you, Jan.
Okay. I just want to say, though, before we start, is that we were very deliberately put ourselves into polarized positions, and we're not really in those positions at all. In fact, there is an incredible amount of commonality with the way when Peter and I got down to work together about the views that we have of this field. But we thought we would start this way, and I want to say that I want to say that there are legitimate gripes on both sides. I think that we are dealing with, I have no doubt that there are there's deplorable ignorance out there about DV. I'm also concerned that we do have a much more differentiated view of the situation. And I think that I also want to say that I have learned a great deal from the advocates over these past 10, 15 years. I think that when we started out on this journey, family court people had mediation and they had education and they had custody parenting coordinators. All of it was with the assumption that the conflict was the problem, that whatever the people were fighting about was probably not important as long as they stopped fighting. Now, I think partly with the help of the advocates, we are now saying there are some serious concerns of abuse and neglect and sexual molest and all kinds of issues in families, in very troubled families that we're seeing, that have to be taken seriously. And I just need to say that before we get into the discussion. I don't know about you, Peter.
I agree. In real life, we're good friends. I have the utmost confidence. If I had a sister who was going through a custody dispute and there was concerns about domestic violence, I would trust Jan as much as anyone because of her knowledge and expertise. So clearly, we're looking at ways in which our systems can do a better job to recognize the existence of violence, to do some differentiation. And clearly, we're a long way. I guess I'm worried with some of the models. I'm worried about some of the research that minimizes the reality of violence, and I think we're looking at much better screening tools. Mm. We're not there yet. I mean, we're in a science that's very young, that's emerging. We need to develop better tools, do better research on them. And I'm worried that if we start to talk about some of the tools too early, they'll be used to minimize and deny the reality of the violence in the real cases. So I think Jan and I would probably agree on many things, but one thing for sure is we don't want to see cases where there is conflict but no abuse or violence mislabeled. At the same time, we don't want to see cases where there are factors related to lethality somehow minimized, just he said, she said. So I guess we're looking to more. We're looking to more to the judges, to the mediators, to the custody evaluators, to ask some of the difficult questions, to do an even better job in terms of screening cases appropriately, putting cases on the right path. And again, one of my concerns would be that I think we do a pretty good job with three-quarters of the cases that come through the systems. But the quarter that exist, that don't go away, where there's a lot of allegations of violence, need to be dealt with in a very different way. We need to be much more thoughtful in terms of the tools we use, how we screen the cases out. And clearly this is one of the things that I know we're all committed to doing. And I also just want to say very briefly, although I know, Jen, you're set up to be the child in the middle, children's issues aren't always separate from the parents' issues. We don't have neat packages of mother, father, children. And children's needs sometimes are very much connected to issues around safety. At the end of the day, I think we all agree that safety has to be the priority. In Ontario and elsewhere, we're seeing more and more children who are killed in the context of domestic violence. We see, and again, there is a gender difference, 95% of murder-suicides, you know, are perpetrated by men. Not all men, I'm just saying that's what the stats are. So we have to be concerned that you may have fathers who've never laid a hand on kids. They've never been involved directly in child physical or sexual abuse, but they still pose a significant threat both to their ex-partner and also to the children. So we recognize that the children aren't a separate package. And although we talk about children's interests and children's wishes, we also recognize that we are concerned about children's safety. And advocates are never going to minimize the reality of children's safety.
Can we come back here to the issue of the topologies we heard about last night? And this is a developing area of research, and both some of the advantages and strengths of that and also some of the risks and disadvantages.
I think Joan made it clear, Dr. Kelly, Joan Kelly made it clear last year that we should not be running around with typologies now and trying to type people. I think the benefits of it are is that it does better reflect reality about the wide range of what's going on out there, and it allows for the better triage. We can start making distinctions if we can do it reliably, and I think we can start making a differential response to better needs of families so that we can get the families that really need the help they need. But the problem is fitting people into boxes, and they don't fit very well into these types. And most of all, there's no reliable screening tools that are out there. And we haven't yet linked parenting capacities to what these different, what does each type, what kind of parenting do you expect under each type? And so if you have no screen, no reliable screening tools, you are, it's just a recipe for disaster regarding serious misdiagnosis, including saying that someone is a separation engendered violent family. Oh, this guy's just violent during the separation. There's no other problem. He's never been violent before. Someone has not clearly seen a pattern of coercive control that's kept his partner under his thumb for years, so that when she makes the break, he becomes lethal. Those kind of mistakes just cannot be made with people who are not qualified and with no screening tools trying to make those distinctions. On the other hand, we are aware that imposing supervised visitation or suspending visitation or kicking people out of the house are serious steps that disrupt family functioning and disrupt parenting and potentially violate civil rights, and we should not be doing those without a lot of care. Most of all, I think these various types of violence, without good screening, without reliable indicators, are an invitation for litigation in the absence of this certainty of what they are. I mean, I can just imagine each parent hiring their different attorneys to argue whether or not this is coercive controlling violence or whether this is separation engendered violence, and it would be horrendous, the implications.
I agree with that. I think some of the research is downright dangerous, just to be frank, because I think it's going to minimize the reality of the violence and the impact. I think, you know, there's a brilliant sentence that I keep citing. Jan had an article back in 1994 in the Future of Children on high-conflict divorce, and the line that Jan had, which I thought was brilliant, is that quite often we're applying the wrong research to the wrong cases, that we're, you know, judges, you know, are working in systems where the presumption is that kids are going to do best when they have an ongoing relationship with both parents. Well, that's good for, you know, 80% of separating couples, but usually not the ones who are coming before the court with multiple allegations. So I'm worried about, in the same way that often judges are applying sort of common wisdom and a presumption of the system that everybody's got to have a mother and a father and have a wonderful relationship with both of them. It does not fit some of the cases we see where there's issues around safety and violence and lethality. So I think we have to really help judges apply the right research to the right cases. So I see some of the research on typology downright dangerous, and quite frankly, I picture myself, as Jan was speaking, I'm going to be in court now, cross-examined, you know, by a common couple violent expert saying, well, you know, you got the wrong kind of violence here, and it's really, you know, it happened once, it was isolated, you know. It can happen once, but it can be reinforced in 100 ways over a relationship, and there has to be a really good analysis, and we have to support our judges to make the best possible decision in these cases.
Yeah, I just want to add that I agree that this the typology research is dangerous at some level, because there is a whole missing element from it, and that is that we can't map parenting capacity from DV typology. We just can't do it, and children continually fall through the ideological cracks when we try to apply these dyadic typologies to then deciding what is the most appropriate parenting plan. So we see children who are wrongly denied contact occasionally, who lose contact with a perpetrating parent, you know, where that parent did, in fact, have some capacity to assist the child with some developmental recovery after the trauma. Certainly we see children who are put into situations where, that contact is wrongly privileged. And these children aren't just the children whose fathers have been involved in, you know, repetitious, overt, physically aggressive violence. These are children who are insidiously re-traumatized by the contact. Mm. And you know, where I would regard these as developmentally lethal contact arrangements.
I guess in terms of thinking about how to deal with different cases, this might be an appropriate time to talk a little bit about the PPP topology or analysis of screening that we've been developing here. As I mentioned, Jan and Peter and I and Claire Crooks have an article that talks about PPP screening. This is the three Ps are the potency of the violence, considering the pattern of the violence, and considering the primary perpetrator. There are actually four P's there, but we looked at the first P, so we have three P's, and there are some more P's coming, but maybe we can just just talk about the three P's at this point. Jan, if you could sort of summarize this topology, this framework, for people who haven't had a chance to read the article.
The basic PPs were the idea of potency, the need. There's a number of dimensions that we think we should be evaluating. So instead of going the topology route, although there is a link back to topologies with this, we thought of looking at the factors we should be looking at. And the potency of the violence, of course, is the foremost dimension that has to be assessed. And that is the degree of seriousness, the degree of dangerousness, the possibility for lethality. That is central to the whole issue of safety, which is the first issue that anyone, and it is a continual issue that we have to come back and cycle through. Because if anyone knows these families, you know that it takes a while for the real understanding of the family to develop, sometimes for months before you really understand what's going on. So potency is the first. The pattern of violence is a critical potential. It tells you for a potential for the future of the violence, the prognosis of the violence. It suggests what kind of interventions are needed. What is this a continuing pattern of coercive control? Is it linked with jealousy and possessiveness? Is it linked with isolation and other forms of control? Is it linked with substance abuse? Is it linked with mental illness? The pattern of the context of the violence will tell you what kind of treatment interventions and services the family are going to need. The third element, of course, is who is the primary perpetrator. This begins to talk about which parent is going to provide a nonviolent home and which parent needs some kind of control. We realized, however, that when we finished this article, when we weren't given any more space to write, that we had left out some important extensions of the parenting capacity of these parents that needs to be assessed. And the fifth one, so the parenting capacity is another element, and the last element is the perspective of the child, that somehow we have to have the child's voice here, or the child's needs, the child's concerns, the child's issues brought to the fore, because that needs to be a part of the process as well. So we've got these, it's sort of an iterative and a cumulative process. You start with safety, you go on to services, and then you go on to the parenting plan over the course of the life of the litigation.
Just to build on that, again, we went out to invent a new psychological test, so there won't be a test appearing anywhere soon in the library called the PPP test. However, I think our hope in writing the article and was really to develop a new framework. So really, what we want is to have tools, a new way of thinking, you know, for judges, for mediators, for custody evaluators. We want people to have another frame of reference to think about cases as they come through the door. So it's very much a plan to help judges generate hypotheses. I mean, we all generate hypotheses, no matter what hat you wear in terms of dealing with families in conflict. You're always generating hypotheses around these issues. So I think the authors are really trying to be much more explicit about thinking about patterns of violence and who the primary perpetrator is, and then thinking what's the relevance for this model in terms of developing the most appropriate parenting plan. So again, it's a way of thinking, it's a way of generating hypotheses, mm-hmm. and that was really our hope. So we made the tool easy enough that judges can use it. Just a joke. Grant, that was a joke. So we wanted to make the tool very, you know, we don't want this to be something that becomes very sophisticated, need, you know, complicated computer analysis and, 30 hours of interviews. We want this that people start developing common languages within and across systems.
My take on this is that crude information leads to developmentally crude parenting plans, and I end up scraping these kids off the wall of my clinic. That the PPP is a step in the right direction, but it's still crude. And it's like giving judges a thermometer where they need an MRI. You know, there's a whole element here that's completely missing from the PPP. And you know, it doesn't go anywhere near telling us or helping us to generate our hypotheses about whether a perpetrator can enter a parenting or a contact arrangement That's developmentally useful to the child. That's psychologically supportive for the child. And, you know, this is what I really want to see addressed in through extension of the PPP, which I know is underway. I have some ideas about what that might look like.
With all respect, though, I think the priority has to be safety. You know, we've all come a long way in this work. We now recognize that if a girl is sexually abused and she tells you, you know, as a therapist or as a custody evaluator, she wants to live with her father, nobody is going to, you know, encourage that contact. But if a boy has a dad who's a batterer, who meets the coercive control and says, I love my dad, I want to be just like him, we all struggle, you know, with doing the right thing in terms of the children's wishes, respecting them at certain ages. So I don't want to minimize the analysis from a child's world, but also we're also looking at issues around children's safety, well-being, what they're exposed to on a regular basis. So
Absolutely, safety is the bottom line. There's no question. And I'm not actually talking at this point about children's wishes. What I'm talking about is when we're making these assessments that we have to get to a far more nuanced position, you know, a position that actually helps us to understand what is the capacity of each parent to support some developmental recovery in the child. And for me, conveniently, that maps into a triple R.
We all got our letters.
Now, somebody stole my thunder last night. I think it was a Claire. Came up with her own triple R. So I haven't got to children's wishes yet, and I'm going to get there. But this is another element that I think that, yes, righto, that we need in our assessments. That we need to be looking at three things to do with each parent, not just the perpetrator. So what is the capacity of each parent for reflective functioning? That is, what is the capacity of each parent to take the child's perspective on the violence, including the child's likely experience of any contact arrangement that comes? What is the child's, what is each parent's capacity for reflective functioning? And here I'm referring to this vast literature in the attachment field and Arietta Slade amongst them. Secondly, what is the capacity of each parent to take responsibility for the child's experience of the violence? And finally, what is the capacity of each parent to assist repair, to repair breaches of trust, you know, through, that might look like appropriate presence through a therapeutic contact plan, or it might be well-managed absence. These things, I think, are vital to getting where children need us to go when we're making these hypotheses.
Jen, can you give us a very brief example of those two different kinds, an example of where repair is possible, and then maybe an example of where it's better to protect the child from that parent?
Absolutely.
And what you found, what you saw in that to make a difference?
Yeah. One of my studies, when I studied about 50 children over the course of a year, and I watched these children in supervised contact visits with violent parents. And my study was really about what helps relationships recover, what helps developmental security to recover. And, you know, there is a case that will stay with me forever because it taught me such a lesson. Imagine this, that a 10-year-old girl, and her father and her mother have had a long history of violence, and the mother has finally managed to leave with the support of a refuge. When she left, immediately before going to the refuge, the father abducted the daughter, attempted to abduct her through the window in the middle of the night at gunpoint. So, I meet this girl a year later, and I meet the father, and I watch them as contact has been ordered to go ahead. Now, you and I might be sitting here shuddering and thinking, oh, bloody hell, you know, just how far have we got to stretch, kids? But here's how it went. This father wasn't just put into an anger management course. Please don't go there with this level of violence. This father had psychotherapy twice a week for a year. And the girl had substantive trauma counselling. And so the father, I'm just going to give you a snippet of what he says to me a year after this violence. He says, it would have been a huge legal battle to avoid coming here to this Connex Centre, you know, but I gave in because it's what my kid needed. I lost the plot a while ago. I got so frustrated with my ex, I tried to pinch Christine from her. The poor little kid got a hell of a fright. And the whole lot of them, they took off for months, couldn't find him. When I did find them, they were terrified of me. Can't blame them. My old man did shit like that to me and my mum. He never said sorry. He never thought about us. I'm going to do it different. I can't have my kid going through life with this on her shoulders. I meet Christine after this particular visit, and this dad had taken her up to the shop to buy some lollies, which, you know, we're all bated breath. Oh, my God, is he going to, you know, what's going to happen here? There was a whole safety plan around that. But she says, you know, I told my dad that I was still scared of him, and he said he understood that. He said I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to. So him saying that really helped a lot. You know, before he used to get drunk and he hit my mum, and once he came over while we were asleep and he took me out of my bed and he had a gun. Well, today he said he was sorry. He said he wouldn't hurt me again and he wouldn't hurt mum again. And yeah, I had butterflies in my tummy, but he said it was up to me to decide and that's the way it was going to go. And my mum said he'd have to work bloody hard to get our trust back. But she thinks Daddy is sorry deep down. And it feels like that to me. And I could go on, and I have actually a 12-year follow-up on this girl who maintained contact with her father and is doing incredibly well. But this is what I call an integrated outcome, okay? From a situation which looked horrific at the beginning, and we might have made judgments and we might have been tempted to say, don't go there. However, the distinguishing feature for this case for me was that the father had capacity. He had capacity for reflective functioning that could be supported and augmented through appropriate therapy. Now, the kind of case where, of course, it is not in the child's best interest is when things remain developmentally toxic and when the parent has no capacity to assist any kind of recovery, when they cannot stand in their child's dependent shoes. And that doesn't necessarily look like a history of volatile violence. Again, for me, this is the more insidious, controlling, a personality-disordered parent who continues to toxically infect their children through the contact.
That's a very powerful example. I guess there might have been a different conclusion if Jan and I had done the assessment in terms of that developing. I guess I don't want to go there, but it strikes me a critical issue is holding individuals accountable for their behavior. And I think that's something I think we have a long way to go within the family justice system to really hold people accountable for what they've done. And by accountable, doesn't mean you're going to jail for 20 years. By holding accountable means that people have to recognize what they've done, the impact of what they've done, you know, on their partner, on the children, actively making amends. So, I mean, clearly, we're all in the helping business. We all want people to get better. We want people to recover. But as long as part of that process isn't minimizing what transpired. And I know you haven't, but I think it's important that we do everything possible in the system to hold people accountable and ask them to be involved in a change process. And often, I guess one of my concerns is too often we're looking for a quick fix. You know, when you're dealing with somebody
absolutely.
Who's...
You might want to talk about the resources issue here, too.
Please.
That is that, you know, what kind of resources that, you know, we have a very skilled therapist here. What kind of resources are out there for the many, many families who are pretty well destitute that... who could hardly afford anything else. They can't afford a supervised visitation, let alone therapy. And I think we've got a big responsibility public policy-wise to consider what we should be doing with families where we cannot offer them the services that they need to recover.
We just finished a study in our province looking at unified family courts in 5 jurisdictions, and we looked at how many meaningful court appearances were there? Did something happen? Did families get access to resources? You know, and based on our analysis, one of the things we concluded was, in large ways, the justice system is like a restaurant with no kitchen. You know, there's lots of menus, lots of ideas, lots of people labeling families, but actually, the government asked us to take out that analogy. They didn't.
They didn't know Peter very well.
Yeah, they didn't find it helpful, but. But in reality, I mean, if you're going through, you know, a divorce or a fixed separation, you want an assessment by Jen and you want counseling by Jen and a second opinion for myself. Just kidding. But the reality is we don't have access to the kind of resources that we need to do a good job. So I think it's a real struggle. And the question, I think the big question is what happens when we don't have those resources? Do we go with something makeshift? I mean, I see lots of cases where I'm really worried about the safety of a visit, so I recommend supervised visitation. And I have a volunteer from the church who's well-intentioned, who's going to volunteer. They don't have the criminal history. They don't have the background. They don't even know why they're supervising. And sometimes they've even been lied to as to why they're supervising. So the question is, what do we do when we have cases where we recognize the developmental issues, we recognize the risk factors, and we don't have adequate resources. And I think we're all trying to get by with not enough, and that's certainly a big concern.
Yeah.
So, Jen, I don't know how you feel about that, because I always feel when we're in these discussions, we all know it's ideal. You know, it's the analogy, whether it's, you know, a thermometer, you need an MRI, whether it's, you know, your brain surgeon, all you have is a hammer and a chisel. How do we get those resources in place?
Yeah.
And if we don't have them, do we engage kids in plans that aren't safe?
Plans. I mean, think this might be a good time to talk about what we've got so far in terms of connecting the PPP ideas about what we should be looking at, including the perspective of the child and the parenting, we'll make it the P5 plan, and the kind of parenting plan that we would come up with, Peter. I mean, you've done a lot of work on this. I've worked with you on it. Can you talk about how this might link to help, to giving some kind of standards for protecting children, even without the use of therapy and other resources, about putting them at least into the right kind of parenting plan?
Well, one of the things we've talked about in the article was really recognizing that there may be a range of outcomes from, you know, the gold standard, which is some sort of co-parenting plan or shared parenting plan, to some sort of more limited visits, supervised exchanges, all the way down to no contact. Because I think Jan and I and Nick and Claire in our article recognize that there's going to be a whole range of individuals. And there are cases where the benefits of access are outweighed by the dangers. I mean, some people don't change. I mean, some people who are involved in violence don't have insights, aren't part of meaningful, you know, batter intervention programs. And clearly, we have to recognize those risks. So we're looking at really a whole range of remedies, all the way from trying to get people back functioning as potential co-parents to there being no contact for the children. And we're recognizing they might need a whole range of resources. These cases are going to require, proper evaluations. They're going to require proper counseling services for victims, for perpetrators of violence, for children. They may require specialized supervised visitation centers. So we're looking at a range of remedies and a range of resources that are required. So again, I think one of the things we're looking at in the article and we're talking about today is it's not a one-size-fits-all, that the days of the system being a sausage factory where everybody comes in, they all get the same programs, and they all turn out the same way are gone. We really need to look at much more at a differential model. We're recognizing all these factors and then having different parenting plans.
We might like to invite you to look at your conference handouts where we have a large table that says, for whom is supervised visitation appropriate? For whom is parallel parenting appropriate? For whom is supervised exchange appropriate? When should you suspend visitation access altogether? Because there's a whole set of criteria that maps into the potency of the violence, the pattern of the violence, the amount of assistance or remedial work that's been done by the family. We're mapping these patterns into specific parenting plans that we're using as a guideline, and we'd like, you know, your thinking about that.
But Jan, one of the things that we really need to cover is the murky issue of false allegations and you know, where does that fit in when you're trying to map into a parenting plan? And I want to hear a bit from Nick about this. I know you have some research in this area.
Well, this gets into the whole issue about lying and exaggeration. I've been privileged to be doing some work in a range of contexts about lying, and, of course, everybody lies. The only question is, when are they doing it, why are they doing it, what's the context? And to me, it's been very interesting working with different mental health professionals. These mental health professionals work in what we call a clinical setting. I've also done work in a lab with lying, because you want to know if somebody lying. Well, one way you do it is you actually observe them lying, and you know they're lying. So one set of studies we did was with very young children, where we would put them in what's called a temptation-resistant paradigm, which means we'd be playing a game with them and tell them, if you win this game, you're going to get a prize. And so a three-year-old child says, that's great, I want the prize, I want the toy. And we set it up that the only way that they can get it is if they cheat, and we leave them alone. And sure enough, a lot of them cheat. And then we ask them, did you cheat? And sure enough, a lot of them lie. And so we have them lying. And the parents get who are watching through a one-way mirror, some of the parents get upset and they say, oh, I didn't know my child didn't lie. Doesn't lie. And we actually have to debrief the parents. They're more upset than the children. And one of the things we say is, well, this is great. Your child has just passed a very important developmental milestone. Your child can lie. And just take it that that's going to be a part of their lives from now on. And indeed,
One of the other things we found out is that you start dealing particularly with mid-school and adolescence is children are usually pretty good liars, especially to their parents. They have a lot of practice at that, and that's why parents are actually particularly bad at telling whether their children are lying. So lying and distortion is just a part of life. And indeed, if people didn't lie, we wouldn't need judges. We'd just say, well, here's the allegation. It must be true. And particularly in the context of domestic violence, we have appropriately and necessarily said, if you come and tell us you're a victim of domestic violence, we will do certain things for you. Just if you tell us that. For example, we'll give you a priority for getting access to living in a shelter. I fully support that. In Kingston, I send money to the shelter. I've had children. I've had my adult children working in the shelter, a very important resource. But there is an advantage there. If you lie, you might get in if you wouldn't. Otherwise, in the legal system, we now say in Canada to a certain extent, if you tell us you've been a victim of domestic violence, the first thing we'll do is you tell the police, we will have your husband taken away from the home and access restricted. This is a way to get very quick justice, emergency orders, restraining orders. All of that, I think, is necessary, but we do have to recognize that some people will be tempted to lie, just as children are tempted to lie when you play games with them. But then the question is, well, so how many of them are doing it? How often are they doing it? And the nice thing about lab-based research is you can actually watch someone lie and you know whether they're telling a lie. If you start doing real-world clinical research, you say, so is mom telling the truth or is dad telling the truth? Who are you going to decide? Is it going to be Jan who's going to decide? Is it going to be a judge who's going to decide? Do I decide? Does Peter decide? How do you know whether someone's telling the truth? Very difficult research to do. But we have done some, and actually Jan has done research, similar research, different methodology, and we've actually had very similar kinds of conclusions, which are very interesting, different countries, different methodologies. And while we found that in some cases lying is an issue, more often I think exaggeration, distortion by victims, but it's very clear that there are many more false denials of abuse than there are false allegations. So is lying, distortion, exaggeration issue? Absolutely. But what about all those false denials? And that's, I think, a really important point. None of that actually helps you deal with a specific case. In each individual case, the judge has to decide based on the evidence that's there. And when I'm talking to lawyers, and I know there are a number of lawyers here, but I would say that cases are decided not based on their facts, but based on the evidence before the court. And so whatever, in fact, happened, if that evidence does not come before the court, the judge is going to say, I'm sorry, the evidence here to prove this is simply not there, and therefore I cannot deny someone their rights, exclude them from the home, terminate the relationship. And so there's a huge issue, and this, of course, very much ties back into resources. Unfortunately, far too often, victims of family violence don't have access to adequate advocacy, adequate legal services, or any legal services, and that's a major issue in the justice system in terms of not getting the protection that they need. There's also a set of systemic issues about information, and so Peter, I think, has talked about lethality assessment. That's a very, very important issue. Often, however, the people, and I feel a great sense of sympathy when for a variety of reasons, but when we have these tragic cases of homicides, often the first thing the media focus on is who is the very last professional who touched that case? Who was the judge who dealt with the bail hearing 2 days ago and released that person? How could they have done that? And then we look back and say, well, they only had a small piece of the information. Now that we've had this tragedy, we discovered all these other people, the police had this information, the psychiatrist had that information, the teacher had that information, but the judge only had this little piece of information and released that person. If the judge had more information, a much better and appropriate decision would have been made and there could have been protection. So we have a lot of systemic issues in the justice system as well and trying to integrate the knowledge that is coming forward as well as the information. And I think the reality also is that when people, professionals, certainly judges and lawyers, are going to have to go out on Monday and work with the knowledge that we have. I know as an academic, as a teacher in a university, almost every student paper I have about any topic in this area, it always ends with the conclusion is, we need more research. And that's a great conclusion, but that doesn't help the judge who has to deal with a case on Monday morning. It doesn't help when the legislature says, I'll wait till you get the research and you validate these instruments. I have to enact a law today with the resource and research that we have. And so what's the best I can do with the information that we have and the resource that we have? So that's...
With respect, though, one thing that family law is not so good at doing is using the available research well. And there is particularly a whole field of research in the attachment literature where, attachments, theorists and researchers have gone such a long way in the child protection field in being able to map predictors of dangerous parenting, parents who do not have the capacity for protective, reflective care. And we have to get better. I mean, the family law field would do well to catch up with what's going on outside of its own domain. Mm.
I mean, there's certainly major issues about how we take social science knowledge and bring it into the justice system. Obviously, the ideal way is, if it's possible, and going to meet the legal standards of different jurisdictions, is to have someone like you or Peter or Jen come to court and testify.
I'd like to ask Peter what you think, how should we think about the disposition of cases where there are unsubstantiated allegations?
I guess I'd want us to seek the
information. In terms of parenting plans.
I guess my first approach would be one of caution. So I guess, in the event there are allegations and there's some basis in fact to consider, I think we need to make more time to at least do an initial assessment, but I think we still have to err on the side of caution. I agree with your concern about civil liberties and having people's rights in some ways being violated. On the other hand, I'm also concerned with balance here and safety when you have some credible allegations. I want to come back to something that Nick said about, judges are only as good as the information they have, which really is a systemic issue. Why don't we demand more information? If I was a judge, I'm still waiting for my appointment. If I was a judge, I would be demanding the very best, because I don't want to be the last person to see a family. So I think we have to demand more from the system. I mean, the number one problem we have, in 2008 isn't false allegations. And I don't want to sort of end here on thinking about all the false allegations. The number one problem we have is people who are abused never coming forward. Three quarters of abuse victims don't reach out. They don't go to the police. They don't go to the court system. So a whole group of people in our society, I mean, we're dealing with domestic violence is really a public health issue. We're looking at rates of violence in teenage relationships. We're talking about a quarter of teenagers in dating relationships involved in some sort of violence. And I think we look at this in a very different way. And I think the court system could play a leadership role. So I guess I'm concerned about us not getting the right information, not demanding it, not having it built into the system at the outset. I mean, most important people in the courthouse sometimes aren't the judges. They're people at the counters. They're the clerks or the people who take initial information. So I think we have to get a lot of people asking some really critical questions so cases get screened in the right direction. And there also are abuse victims who are in the court. They don't even report that they're being abused. I mean, some people don't report being abused because they don't recognize that what they've experienced is abuse. I mean, half the clients I see may say they're not abuse victims, but if you do a standard structured questionnaire about sexual violations, physical abuse, financial abuse, I mean, there is an abuse history. They've never labeled it as such. And we also, quite frankly, have people who are abused never want to tell anybody. Because if you talk about abuse, although Nick, you talked about it as a trump card, that people may be using abuse to get a leg up. The reality is if you raise issues of abuse and you don't have the evidence, you don't have a medical report, which are rare, if you don't have the police report, which is rare, it's going to come back to bite you. You're going to be seen as a malicious mother raising these allegations, and it could actually send the system into a tizzy. So abuse victims are also underreporting because they're not sure the system is safe to actually report to, and I don't think we want to ignore that. So I think we have to demand the most of our system to get the proper information and to go beyond a checklist which simply says, are you an abuse victim, yes or no? We have to be able to ask those questions and get judges meaningful information.
I mean, I think that, the issue of, and I thought you were going to for a moment talk about, it's not only, of course, false allegations, but also false recantations. So there's a whole other set of issues, particularly in the child protection system, about genuine victims who disclose and then recant. We had a very disturbing case in Toronto where a woman, I'm convinced, was significantly and repeatedly abused by her partner late in pregnancy, reported it to the police, then said, I don't want this to go ahead. And then she ended up in jail on a warrant because, you have to come to court and testify against it. So she was in jail waiting her the birth of her child as well. Eventually, a judge did release her after she said, this didn't happen at all. I think absolutely everyone who looked at that was convinced that, of course, it did. And that's another challenge for the justice system. And I think then differentiating the case and having the appropriate response is very appropriate and very difficult and really a challenge for all of us. We're starting to run out of time, and I know as an educator that there's one thing that people are concerned about in education is it's one of the very few things that people pay for. They don't want more than the original bargain. So we're going to conclude here. I'm going to ask each of you to identify three wishes that you have. And I know that's something that assessors sometimes do with children. What are your three wishes for this field? And perhaps we'll start with you, Jan.
I wanted to start with both a fear and a wish or a hope. My fear is that the field is extremely polarizing politically, and it's polarized and it is polarizing. And so what I'm most afraid of is that no matter what we have said or may say in the future, we're going to continue to be seen as either allies or enemies of either women's rights or men's rights. We're going to be misquoted and pitted against one another in the undercurrent of conversation that runs through our communities that sometimes amounts to no more than scuttlebutt and rumour mongering. My hope is that we're going to continue to work on these issues together, keep communicating across the divide, protecting victims, rebuilding parent-child relationships, finding ways of helping traumatized children to heal, rehabilitating offenders. I think, how can we do this? I think we need to keep communicating, keep working together. Recently, Peter heard through the grapevine that some negative remarks that were made about advocates' views at a conference that I attended, and he wrote me an email to check it out, and we had a useful exchange, which I think helped to neutralize what could have been polarizing forces. A second thing is I think we need to encourage our family court professionals to keep their balance in the field, in this polarized field, by focusing squarely on the needs and perspectives of children and appealing to the parents to do the same. And we've always found that the only neutral territory, really, with these highly conflict families is that we all want what is best for their kids, including these parents at some level. And this means strengthening parents' capacities to protect their children from violence, facilitating the children's recovery from trauma, and assuring that parents have the ongoing support they're going to need to nurture their children in whatever limited capacities are available. And finally, I do want to say that I want to remain and respectful of advocates. They are our watchdogs. They bring into focus and advance the legitimate needs and perspectives of individuals, both mothers and fathers, who are unable to speak for themselves or whose voices are dismissed or drowned by the dominant discourse or subjugated by prevailing institutional biases. So the last thing I want to say is that I do hope that we can invite... I'm very respectful of an incredible amount of array of expertise and knowledge and wisdom in this room. These are the best of the best across the United States and Canada and Australia. And we want to help invite you into this collaborative effort. We're going to have a workshop that follows this. And if you've got ideas, if you're burning to say something, if you've got things that you can contribute, just please send them along. And we'd like to hear from you more.
Thank you. Peter?
Three things. I think one is more collaboration. I mean, this is a very exciting initiative to have AFCC and the National Council, Juvenile and Family Court judges, working together. So I really want to build on the relationship that Billy Lee and Peter have established. So I think we really need to be talking to each other in a much more open dialogue. So clearly the discussion we're having here hopefully will be repeated throughout the conference. So I think that's the key. I'd like to see more researchers and clinicians being like Jan Johnson. I think, Jan, you're the gold standard in terms of asking the difficult questions and then making sure people always apply the right research, the right cases. So I guess I'd like us to all strive for the gold standard, and you are the gold standard. And last but not least, I want to put a plug in for prevention. I think no matter where we are in this debate, violence in relationships, violence against women is a public health issue at tremendous cost across our society. So I guess I'd like to see us all involved in schools. I think to avoid burnout, we should all spend at least 1 hour a week in a school talking about healthy relationships, conflict resolution, alternatives to violence. I think we have to look at a society where violence is seen as entertainment. You know, in the best picture of the year, is No Country for Old Men, that most of you would be too frightened to watch. You know, when we're looking at graphic violence being mainstream, when we look at pornography now leading the media, the number one aspect of media industry is pornography and violent pornography. It's taking over our lives. It's a training manual for men on sexual assault. We have to speak out on these issues, not because we're taking sides, because we're concerned about our sons and our brothers and our fathers. So I really want you actively involved in prevention, both with boys and girls, around this issue. It's interesting that the leading feminists in my community are all men in their 50s with fathers in their 20s. All of a sudden, the light goes on. All of a sudden, all these people are marching for years and realize while they're marching what the issues were. Because when you start to worry about your daughter and your daughter's safety, then you recognize the public health issues that are involved. So I also pray for prevention and being actively involved in schools and communities to really address this issue in a much deeper way. Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel much better now that Dad said Mum's got the gold standard. And
we're doing it for you.
Thank you, darling. So I have three wishes. And the first is that my US colleagues, with respect to resources, that you might be able to suggest to Bush that there are weapons of mass developmental destruction in domestic violence, and that he might, consider allocating that. Kind of siphoning off a few billion dollars from that would be great. I have two wishes. One is on the research front. Look, our research in domestic violence, particularly in the family law field, it has to become more complex in its developmental agenda. And we need to move away from counting allegations, from keeping track of the numbers and rates and types of legal responses and rulings. We need to examine associative data. We need to map developmental outcomes for children relative to the behaviour and the capacity of each parent. On the assessment front, I wish for family law that it would stop flirting with attachment and developmental literature and marry it and have a real integration of this specialist knowledge base so that we can raise the bar on assessment and we can employ sophisticated, well-validated approaches for assessing capacity for reparative parenting.
Well, I